Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's show, the art of politics.
Although all these activities and protests, etc., can generate a feeling of solidarity, I don't think they will convince the other side. And I wonder whether it would be wise for artists nowadays and designers to consider ways of reaching out.
Coming up, more on art and design as a weapon in propaganda and protest. Before we get to that, though, art and design at the movies.
Every art is represented in movies. Movies are a salad bar of the arts. Yeah, salad bar.
This is director Brad Bird. He made The Incredibles and Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And here's part of an acceptance speech that he gave for a Cinematic Imagery Award that he received at the Art Directors Guild Awards that took place earlier this month.
Production designers and art directors must understand architecture, history, theater, and the psychology of dreams, because good art direction is the art of constant communication without saying a word.
And at this Sunday's Oscars, five pairs of production designers and set decorators will compete for the Production Design Award. The nominees are Arrival, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Hail Caesar, La La Land and Passengers. To talk about the designers of these films and what to watch for on Sunday night, we called up Tom Walsh. He's past president of the Art Directors Guild and he produced their awards event.
You couldn't have five more different films to one another. We're at a kind of a golden age right now in terms of production design. We have incredible collection of tools, both digital and analog, to work from. And it's probably the best time to do this and the hardest time to do this because, unlike the studio days, we have to start from scratch with every project. But there's nothing in common other than the quality of the work and the storytelling, which is superior on all counts.
Let's start with two films that do have something in common, which is they are both set in Hollywood. One is Hail Caesar, with production design by Jess Gonchor, set decoration Nancy Hay. The other is La La Land, production designer David Wasko, with set decoration by his wife and professional partner Sandy Reynolds Wasko. And both of them, in their own way, romanticize Hollywood.
Certainly, they're both nostalgic towards a Hollywood that no longer exists, or one wish comes, in the case of La La Land, the Hollywood that you're searching for. I'm a native of Hollywood, and I went to Hollywood high school. My father was at MGM in the 40s, so both of those films spoke to me personally because they're all experiences that I've had or through my friends have had. And neither one of those worlds exists, so they had to create them. I mean, La La Land obviously used Hollywood and L.A. as its principal backdrop and source material, but they did, you know, like the observatory scene where they're dancing in the sky. There was a minimal amount of sort of compositing, CG compositing, but it was basically, it reveled in being an in-camera film. Hail Caesar is truly trying to celebrate the golden era of the studio system and sort of revel in all of that with the behind-the-scenes stage productions and using, you know, Warner Brothers for exteriors and using the lot in Hollywood for all their built sets on real stages where those films were shot in the past. That one was an enormous amount of craft and craftspeople because it, you know, they had all those moments. I mean, just think of the Esther William moment alone and working in the tanks and then huge submarine and real backdrops. I mean, they kind of approached it as a making movies in the 50s as opposed to using a lot of techniques to enhance it and extend it.
So, okay, let's go off into outer space and Arrival and Passengers. I attended your the Art Directors Guild Awards ceremony, and
right.
I noticed that Guy Hendrix-Dyas was given the award for Passengers. He got a very, very warm reception, a much warmer reception than the movie itself got critically, mm-hmm. You know. So what was it about Passengers that you think really kind of impressed his peers?
Well, it's the level of craft and detail. I mean, it's extraordinary amount of work. The one thing that both it and Arrival have in common is they actually applied science and scientific logic in the creation and execution of their worlds. So there's a level of detail and plausibility that exists, which makes them actually intelligent movies. I think Passenger's problem is more of a script and story problem towards the latter third, but I'm not here to discuss that. I think I applaud what they did because, you know, on Passengers, they sort of created this sort of hybrid of the ultimate cruise liner and casino and mega mall in space, you know, traveling 120 years to a destination. I mean, it's a fantastic concept to then realize. And I never for a minute questioned the world that I was in when I was seeing that movie. And that, I mean, but I think that was a movie that even Kubrick would have appreciated. And it's obviously it's based in those sort of principles going back to 2001. And they took the 2001 theme and concept and took it, you know, to its own level, which didn't feel like it was redundant or derivative. But they took like, a story and they made it their own. And, you know, the same thing can be said for Arrival. The first encounter theme, that really felt like a real international moment and not just science fiction.
Arrival's an interesting one. In fact, Patrice Vermette, who's up for that award, he wrote that I guess one of the challenges for designing a movie that deals with an alien invasion, you know, these films have been locked into the collective consciousness.
Absolutely.
He says there is an aesthetic consensus of alien spaceship design, you know, so he was trying to come up with something that I guess didn't fall so neatly into that consensus. And he goes for a look that's both kind of ethereal, and there's something, I guess, very minimal about it.
Oh, it is very minimal. He was channeling the artist James Turrell. It's very evident, and he speaks to that with, you know, a respect. Arrival is kind of a very poetic haiku poem about a different logic, a different being, a different way of thinking, a different history. They created the complete world, and it was completely satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and visually it was immaculate.
Sure. And then we have Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Production designer Stuart Craig, set decorator Anna Pinnock. Why did you laugh?
Well, it's just, how does that aesthetically relate to any of the other four films? They're all uniquely personal stories, and they're all done at, you know, the impeccably height of their craft. I mean, Stuart is the senior master in this group of designer storytellers. In Beast, just the whole concept of the zoo in a suitcase, I mean, that was fantastic and theatrical. You know, I loved every minute when we were down in that, you know, in the bottom of that suitcase. You know, Stuart is one I think we all look to and admire as a designer and as a gentleman. He is truly one of our leaders.
And we should say that he has been nominated in the past for 10 Academy Awards. He's won 3.
Not bad.
For Gandhi, for Dangerous Liaisons, and for The English Patient. You said that, in a way, this is kind of, you know, a golden age for production design because you have so many tools at your disposal. And yet it's also very sort of challenging because you're having to reinvent the wheel with every project because
of everyone
not having a studio system. Perhaps you feel there were some benefits to the studio system.
Oh, yeah. Well, they taught us how to make things on an industrial scale. What they really were is they were advanced universities because this industry, you know, you get your training in art school or and such, but this is an on-the-job training kind of industry. It's a craft. And the thing about the studio systems that I love so much is they were advanced universities for craft and applied engineering and applied learning. And everyone learned from each other because they were in whatever studio you're at, whether it was MGM or Warner Brothers or whatever, you learn from each other and they became generational. You would have, second and third generations following their parents.
Like you.
Yeah. Well, my father was an actor. Thank God I didn't follow in his footsteps.
Oh.
But my son has. So my wife and I say, well, there you go. But, you know, the point is you learn from others that have made the mistakes first. And it's the failure recovery aspect that the studio system permitted people to make those advances from. I mean, it's much harder, I think, to be a director or writer these days because you just don't get the ability to, you know, make multiple mistakes because things are so expensive.
What happens to the sets, the actual built sets, not the CGI sets?
The actual built sets, most all of them go into dumpsters and landfills. I mean, when there was a studio system, everything was recycled and reused, which is what was one of the smarter aspects of the studio system. They were very efficiently smart. Now, no studio wants to keep any assets. So unless it's like a hero piece or pieces, like from the Harry Potter canon as an example, where those pieces will go into the corporate archives because nobody wants them going out there on eBay and profiting off of the film. Specific things in wardrobes are kept in storage, but everything else, sadly, goes into the dumpster.
It's horrendously wasteful. But could you tell people which dumpsters? Because I'm sure they'd like to go and get pieces of the sets.
Well, I think the landfills, and they're from Atlanta to upstate New York to the Mojave Desert now. I mean, it's tough because the studios have always regarded everything as a necessary evil, especially where the art department's concerned. And, you know, you want to get them on and off the clock as fast as you can. A few things, especially the sci-fi stuff that's really labor-intensive, may end up in prop houses, storage, and for repurposing a future point after the movie's been released. I wouldn't be surprised if the medical doc from Passengers may be in somebody's storage unit waiting for future rental. But it's hard. It's hard to keep that stuff.
There was Tom Walsh, former president of the Art Directors Guild. He's also an Emmy Award-winning production designer who's currently working on the Netflix show Longmire. This coming Saturday, Tom will co-host a discussion with all the nominees for the Production Design Oscar. It'll be at the Egyptian Theatre. Go to our website, kcrw.com/DNAblog, for details. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, art, design, and politics. Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. There has been an explosion of visual expression in reaction to the Trump administration, from the design of pink pussy hats to, this past weekend, an art show by the undocumented in Boyle Heights. So how much of a role do artists play in protesting or promoting a regime? Yousse Segal is chief curator at the Vended Museum of the Cold War, and he's author of Art and Politics Between Purity and Propaganda. In this book, he looks at a century of art movements and how they became weapons in the fights over totalitarianism and fascism, communism and capitalism.
Even if an artwork seems to be art for art's sake, seems to be a very pure artwork, in social life and in political life, it inevitably gets a political meaning at some point.
Segal writes, for example, about how Diego Rivera tried to squeeze Marxist messages into murals for the Rockefeller Center, how one of the Nazis' degenerate artists was in fact a devotee of the regime, and how the US government used abstract expressionism as a weapon in the Cold War, in part because the powerful art critic Clement Greenberg had declared it a truly apolitical, pure art form.
Was part of traveling exhibitions of American art throughout the world, and especially focused on Europe, partly supported by the State Department and the United States Information Agency, to show the openness and variety of American culture, again, as opposed to the very strictly controlled East Bloc countries. But then, in this case, there was also a very strong political current at the time in the United States and in the art world who actually interpreted modern art as part of a communist plot to destabilize American society.
Okay, it's so interesting, but let's now move to the current period. And we have President Trump in the White House, and his campaign and now his administration has brought forth a huge outpouring of expression. Have you been watching what's going on right now from your vantage point as an art historian, and what would you say about it?
Yeah, no, of course. I think First of all, there's a very interesting difference between the case studies of my book and the current situation. I wanted to make the point in my book that starting in the First World War, there always have been these very strong oppositions in the art world that were played out in a political way. For instance, the opposition between national art and international art in the First World War, or between modern degenerate art and national art during the Third Reich, or between engagement in art and bourgeois decadence in the eyes of the Soviet Union, etc., etc. But that seems not to be the case right now. There is no opposition. And maybe that is because apparently Trump doesn't like art very much. So there is also not an art form that can easily be associated with the Trump administration.
Oh, I see. So you're saying that Trump has not stated a preference for a particular visual language that people can then react against, except mm-hmm. that in a way he has, in as much as he seems to be maybe not so interested in fine art per se, but he certainly seems to be interested in interiors. You know, he mm-hmm. has a notable love of gold. British design critic Stephen Bailey referred to his Trump Tower apartment as a glitter ball of Rococo kitsch.
Right. that's absolutely true, but that's very idiosyncratic, I would say. And there is not a strong art movement right now of people who say we all need these Rococo interiors in order to identify with a certain political direction. Yeah.
Except perhaps yeah. Russian oligarchs. One does associate sure. a certain sort of Rococo kitsch with some of the super wealthy of some of the less democratic countries, perhaps.
That's true. And maybe also interesting to mention here is that Trump was filmed standing in front of his Scottish golf course and mentioning, "I am an artist and this is my canvas," pointing to the golf course. So
even as there isn't an art movement to react against and say we are not of that movement, there has been an outpouring of sort of artistic expression. We have up from the grassroots design of this pussy hat that became a kind of instant global symbol, through to MoMA, you know, deciding that it will make its critique of the ban on folks coming from seven majority Muslim countries by taking the Western art off the walls and putting the art of those countries on the walls. So they sort of made an active statement. Right. Here in LA, we have the Hammer Museum, where its director, Annie Philbin, has really pushed a kind of a program of art as activism. Is there a precedent for this kind of thing?
No, I don't think in this form. I wanted to add one aspect to Trump as an artist, which I think is quite interesting, and that is the fact that what he's doing now could be interpreted as something that has been done by artists in former times, which is creating an alternative reality again.
So if you were to give him an art historical label, would he be a surrealist or a Dadaist or
a conceptual Dadaist, I guess. that combination would do it. But to come back to your other question about what is going on now in the art world, I think that's quite interesting, and it is quite important now that not only artists, by the way, but people stand up to the values they stand for and feel are of crucial importance. But I have one little concern there, and that is that although all these activities and protests, etc., can generate a feeling of solidarity, I don't think they will convince the other side. And I wonder whether it would be wise also for artists nowadays and designers to consider ways of reaching out and creating a public forum where you can actually be in contact with people with other realities and other convictions.
Do you think the museums have a role to play in this? I mean, clearly MoMA's action, and even more explicitly Hammer's action with its kind of courses in how to be an activist around mm-hmm. the issues that are generally agreed upon by the left, not the right.
Right.
Do you think museums have a role, given that, I guess, some of them, they are nonprofits. Would you say they have a role in trying to have a visual conversation that is more open?
Absolutely. And actually, we're trying to do that also at our museum, at the Wendy Museum. So we are starting next month a lecture series called Art Past Present. Also, by the way, our current exhibition in an interesting way relates to it. It's called Questionable History. And what we try to do there is turn around the more traditional approaches to exhibitions where you have one master narrative. So in this exhibition, every work has two or sometimes three text labels with all accurate historical information, but sometimes completely different interpretations.
That's so interesting.
And I think that's also important to do such a thing right now in terms of alternative facts, because this exhibition is not about alternative facts. It's about accepting facts as they are, but exploring the range of possible interpretations of these facts.
That was Yousse Segal. He's author of Art and Politics, Between Purity and Propaganda. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. We're going to conclude with a strange story from the Cold War. Back when they were busy creating the buildings of tomorrow, 40 of the top modernist architects of the era, including Richard Neutra, Louis Kahn and Eero Saarinen, received a mysterious invite to come to the Institute of Personality Assessment and Research at the University of California at Berkeley. Why? Historian Pierluigi Serraino has the story in his latest book, The Creative Architect, Inside the Great Mid-Century Personality Study.
The idea was really to understand the personality traits of the creatives. Who are the creatives? What kind of environment that they were raised in? What kind of environments they can operate at their best? What their life history was, what their motivation was. So here we have the greatest of their era in a very confessional setting dish out everything about themselves, everything that they're willing to reveal, and tell their story. And it's an extraordinarily fascinating story.
More about their revelations later. First, though, let's back up and learn about the group doing the testing, the Institute of Personality Assessment and Research, also known as IPAR, run by a man named Donald MacKinnon. During the war, he had worked for the Office of Strategic Services. That was the precursor to the CIA. And there he had conducted psychological tests on prospective spies. The goal was to find candidates who would be most effective under duress. After the war, the same testing tools were applied, but now the goal was to identify creativity.
What changed the pace was the launching of the Sputnik. Really, the idea was to figure out a way to have more creatives be part of American society and the American educational infrastructure so that we could outdo the Russians.
You know, creative is bandied around. It's become a noun. People are referred to as creatives. But back then, when they start this test, there's a real fascination with the idea of creativity. Talk about that.
Well, this is the era of the expert society. This was the era also where science had carte blanche in establishing and making knowledge. So the fact that science thought that creativity could be studied was a very important stepping stone in clearing the fog from what was called armchair theory. But to actually have the architects or the writers of the most consequential people in their field come to an institution and submit themselves to tests, it's something that had never been done before and was never done afterwards.
Donald MacKinnon reached out to artists and writers and scientists, but his favourite group was architects. They apparently were more pliant than the 18 writers he invited, among them Truman Capote. They apparently fought back against the tests. But mainly MacKinnon was interested in architects because he felt they represented a unique mix of artistic and scientific creativity coupled with the art of salesmanship.
And they created a list, and on top of the list there was Frank Lloyd Wright. And Frank Lloyd Wright was 92 at the time of the study, so he never returned a response to that letter. The second was Mies van der Rohe, who said, "I'm awfully busy, I'm not going to come." And the third was Eero Saarinen. So that was not an insignificant one. And among the first 10, there was also Philip Johnson and Richard Neutra. So although they didn't get everybody they wanted to have, they got a significant sample.
So the architects arrived at the research centre, and right away the testing started. They were given psychological tests and interviews. They were given fast-paced drawing sessions where they had to fill empty squares with ideas. They were given conformity studies and personality tests. The participants were even asked to rank one another's creative prowess.
Most of them were multiple choices. Then they had interviews which were very colorful because they were all transcribed. And there's the description of how the architects arrive. Saarinen, for example, is described as very nervous coming in, is using sketching as a way to talk, whereas Kahn enters the room in a spirit of great cooperation. He shakes the hand, a big smile. Johnson was extremely combative. He did not want to be there. He did not answer many questions. He was jumping up and down. In fact, the researchers said that he was exhibiting manic type of behavior.
What does the group, the staff at IPAR, do with all their findings?
They write papers. Donald McKinnon goes around the country and abroad, broadcasting some of the findings with the promise of a book that will come out, and the book never comes out.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, the only surviving scientist, Ravenna Helson, from the period, said there was too much testosterone in that room. Each scientist took ownership of a particular segment of the study, and it sort of broke down.
So there's a lot of testosterone among the architects.
Yes.
And then you're saying there's testosterone among the scientists.
Yeah,
that's pretty hilarious.
Yes, it is hilarious. In fact, there's only Ravenna Helson is the only woman in this group. She will be in charge of studying women mathematicians, and she does a study on Mills College students that she follows over time. So there is an attempt to include women, but I mean, it's very clear that they treat it as a minority group. So effectively, I wrote the book that they never did, except that I also added the part that they would have never written, which is how they constructed the experiment.
So what in the end did the researchers conclude about the nature of creativity? Sarah Eno says they found the creative person works best alone, and even in groups their ideas lead the way. Also, they found creativity is not fueled by IQ or talent alone. Rather, the creative person has to be driven by a motivation to create and has the courage to act on his or her own intuition.
The mechanism of repression does not exist in the creative. The creative person just tries things and is the courage to accept the failure of that attempt without think of this as a setback, because the creative does not have identity issues. There is an obsessiveness about keeping trying to do work that is better than the previous one, work that has not only solved a problem, but it has to be aesthetically beautiful. You can solve the problem in very ordinary ways, so to speak, but the creative wants to solve the problem in a very beautiful way.
That was Pierluigi Serraino. He is author of The Creative Architect, Inside the Great Mid-Century Personality Study. He'll give a talk about the book and sign copies at Modernism Week in Palm Springs. His talk will take place this Friday, February 24th. See our website, kcrw.com/DNAblog, for details. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. Ray Guana mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening.